a pepperoni pizza for the table.
Thank you.
And may I suggest trying it with our Pepsi Zero Sugar? It has just the right amount of sweetness to complement all that cheesy, saucy goodness, while the carbonation and notes of citrus enhance the flavor profile. Simply divine.
Pepsi Zero Sugar? You've really outdone yourself this time. Pizza deserves Pepsi.
If scary movies give you dread, keep you up late night in bed, here's a podcast that will help you ease your mind. We'll explain the plot real nicely, then we'll talk about what's frightening so you never have to have a spooky time. It's Ruined.
Hello, welcome to Ruined. I'm Hallie.
And I'm Allison.
This is a podcast. We ruin a horror movie just for you.
Just for all of you. Hallie, how are you doing?
I'm okay psychologically myself. I feel like last night I had, we're recording this Wednesday, April 23rd. Yeah. So it's the week of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And my day job over at Love It or Leave It, which is a live comedy podcast, in case you are a new listener, there's a DC show and I don't have to go, but I'm on East Coast time. And yeah. I will say, again, every week it's like a new level of concern about humanity. And again, not even in a pessimistic way, just like a, how do we stop doing this? How do we get out of this loop? Or how do we get out of where mm-hmm. we're at now? And I think this week it really is the Pete Hegseth stuff, where it's like, yeah. even the illusion, which of course we've been told, I think throughout history, that like an evil government could also, but like the trade-off for evil is functionality. And it's like, well, but
right.
they're not functional. Nope. They're incompetent. Pete Hegseth just texting anybody anything. And we've talked about this, I think, out of the pod, but like he allegedly sent some intel to a text thread that had his wife on it.
Yes.
Amongst other people. And there was a previous report that his wife was coming to official meetings with him. And it's just insane to see that Trump administration double down on a bad guy.
Right.
But again, that's patriarchy. Like, it's like there's almost like no right. other response to recognize that he's incompetent and shouldn't have this job would be to recognize
yes.
that
the
Trump
whole thing
himself,
falls apart.
Exactly.
Yes.
So I understand it from that level, but it's like, how do you talk to these people of like, I swear to God, you also don't want this guy in charge of anything.
Right.
Right.
Like, and know. This is like, he's such a, like, the stakes are very high with that job. For every single person on the planet.
Yeah.
So I don't see why these people like continually are like, no, this is fine. It's like, so you're good with him just like sharing that like classified national security clearance stuff with like whoever about war?
Yeah, and this seems related. I saw like a little clip of basically these farmers talking about, you know, with mm-hmm. the reporter about sort of like how the tariffs are going to affect American farmers. And they asked this one woman sort of like, are you concerned? And she just said like, well, you know, we have faith in God. And I'm like, I don't know what religion you're a part of that you think God won't let your farm absolutely bottom out, considering yeah. all the other stuff that he's allowing. And to hear it in 2025, it's like, it is one yeah. thing to have a private faith that, you know, gives sure. you something and helps you sort of maybe add form to like what I believe is like an innate human desire to help other people. It is quite another to be like, I'm going to ignore Trump's economic madness because yes. I think God's going to step in and not let my personal business bottom out. I think we're past it, guys. I think we're just past it.
Yeah.
Other than that, personally, I feel okay. So I don't know. Yeah. I that's always a weird feeling. But yeah, I feel like a new level of being like, all right, well, we have to have to be able to analyze this. And I hope more and more of us are. So
yes.
Allison, how are you doing?
I did see a very funny meme. And it's like so frustrating when you see something funny, but it's about this. Because you're like, it's not worth having this happened just to have some funny stuff, but somebody like, it was like an old photo of like a battleship board like just like kind of, and somebody was like, oh, Pete Hegseth just texted me this.
That's so very funny.
But it's like, again, I'd rather not have that joke than have this be our reality.
Well,
I'm fine.
Okay, good.
Just gearing up for allergy season.
Yes,
Riz is on a diet. You know, just lots of stuff going on over
now,
here.
Now, is that a vet mandated diet?
No, but they were like, try not to let him get like bigger. He's like a healthy weight, but they were like, don't let him get bigger than he is.
Okay.
And he's been real whiny for like more food. And I'm like, bro, you gotta stop. You can't eat as much as you eat. It's too much. You're
Listen,
a little chunkster.
I'm right there with Riz, so I'm completely empathetic.
Yes,
and the problem is I have thumbs and I can open the fridge. So
I know, right. It's like I keep going back and eating more pasta salad, but he's like screaming for like 1-2 calorie treat, and I'm like, I'm sorry, you've had enough.
God, don't let him fight up a pasta salad.
Just wanted to be a healthy boy.
He's gonna evolve hands so he can make pasta salad himself.
Yes, he's going to. Yeah, I just like I took a picture of him and he was laying down loafing, and I was like, he looks like a microwave. Like he needs to. He's just like a big cube. So we gotta get you a little trimmer, buddy.
Speaking of something that continues to get bigger and bigger.
Perfect.
We are in the midst of Mom Month. We are doing movies picked by our moms. And this week we are doing one from my mother. This is a movie that she has oft brought up throughout my life as something that she saw too young and really stuck with her. And that, of course, is 1959's Kaltiki, the Immortal Monster.
Hey, everybody. This is me with my mom, Mary Jane. And we, of course, are talking about the 1959 movie Kaltiki, the Immortal Monster, which I remember hearing about as a child. Mom, do you want to tell us about your experience of seeing Kaltiki as a kid?
I would. You know, I didn't know how old I was, but when you looked into it a little bit, you found out it was actually released in 1960 in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming it probably got on television a little after that, don't you think?
Yeah.
And so that meant I would be at least between 8 and 10, maybe as close to 10, but I would have been 8 in 1960. I don't know how it is that I got to watch it. I was the only one that watched it in my family. And it was at night because they used to put movies on Saturday night that you could watch, unlike today where you can see movies whenever you want. It was only at specific direct times. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that it must have been after the American release because I'm pretty sure there wasn't subtitles. I had probably never seen subtitles at before, so I could understand what was going on. I can't tell you the narrative from watching it, but I do remember this, and to this very day, I remember this. So I remember being pretty scared afterwards and going up to bed. Now, I slept in a bedroom with my two other sisters, and I was in a double bed with one of them. And so I go into bed, and at that point, I can't get up again. Like, I couldn't get up to go to the bathroom or do anything else because I was afraid the Kaltiki blob had crept across the floor of my bedroom and it was like on the floor. So I thought that if I put my leg out, my leg would dissolve because that's what happened in the movie. The flesh dissolved off the bones. So I mean, that's how it was. So I can't even believe. I'm sure my parents might not even known that I had watched it. They might have been sleeping. But it left an indelible impression. As for anything else that happened in that movie, I can't tell you. I'm really looking forward to you talking about it.
Great. Thank you, Mom.
Yeah, I think my mother is correct. There are elements of this and certain images that are genuinely terrifying. And to see this as a child before you like 100% know that Kaltiki the Immortal Monster can't exist.
Yes.
Deeply unsettling.
100%.
You're losing sleep over it. So we always like to have Allison watch a trailer. Allison, what did you think about the Kaltiki the Immortal Monster trailer?
I feel like I don't know if I'll find the plot scary, but the images are very scary. Like, again, like to be young, to be like too young to know this is a movie and that this can't happen and see this would be really upsetting. Cause like some of it, I was like, ew, this is gross. I don't want to see this. And like, I don't find that with like the practical effects of like the 50s typically.
Yes, I agree. There's a disgusting element. And then the monster itself, because this is obviously the era of the blob. And I think they were getting a lot of blob adjacent horror horror movies.
Yes, everything's very blobby.
These are obviously practical effects. It's an Italian movie, which my mother also didn't mention, and is funny because I don't think she remembered that it was in Italian. But watching it, it was like a genius did the effects. So some of them are really scary, and some of them, the blob looks like a pair of wet jeans that you just pulled out of a washing machine, and it just depends on the shot. And so it really, it's very, it gives you a lot of appreciation for filmmaking itself, in addition to having some like genuinely upsetting moments. We always like to take a baseline scary. Allison, how scary would you find the concept of an immortal blob monster?
Oh, very.
Mm-hmm.
It's seemingly like, what do you even do? It's like, well, I guess this is here.
That's exactly the question.
And that I don't like that.
What would you do if you were confronted with such a thing, Allison?
I let it kill me. I don't know.
It's been a minute since you pulled the Allison special.
Just be part of it. I don't know. What am I supposed to do? Run away from it? It like keeps getting bigger, and it's so wet.
It's so wet. It, at certain points, it looks like it's like covered in, I don't even know, Laffy Taffy or sequins. Yeah. Like it has a brittle, shiny exterior, but then when it pulls apart, it's like a thick mucus. It's great. I thought the effects were top-notch.
The vibe of it is like large tumor.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, mine was deflated, soaking wet denim basketball that is like moving around and absorbing things.
Yeah, like that's something that I just, I can't win. So,
hey, Elsie,
but
you just can't win with Kaltiki, the immortal monster.
Not with Kaltiki, the immortal monster.
I agree. I would try to run, but you know that thing's just swimming over my shins, and I'm going down for the count.
Right, I'm like running at a full sprint. It's just like moving. It's like, all right, well, I'm not faster than moving.
Yeah, it's like, you can go wherever you want. I'm the blob. I'm everywhere.
Right.
And then finally, Allison, would you like to guess the gist of Kaltiki, the immortal monster?
Guess the twist.
I'm going to guess, not so much the gist, but that by the end, that the monster does take over the whole town.
Oh, okay, great.
That, like, everybody's gone, and it, like, it's off to go do more of whatever it does.
I'm loving that. That's fabulous. Yeah. Also, just to be clear, this is an Italian language film, and so in Italian, the name of the movie is Kaltiki, il monster immortale, which I think is just classy
chic.
As hell. Very chic. Hey guys, just popping in to tell you about our next live show, which is coming up Sunday, May 25th. And we are doing Ryan Coogler's historic vampire horror. We couldn't be more excited, Sinners.
Yes.
So please join us. It is at a regular time, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern.
Yes, and you can see all the stuff we normally do at a live show that you've come to know and love, like the chat, drinking games, and of course, merch classic. So you can get your tickets at moment.co/ruined. I know we tried something else last month. We're back to, once again, the bread and butter of things we kind of know. So moment.co/ruined, $20 Patreon to your members. You know you're going to get a ticket in your inbox the day of. And everyone else, please join us. I'm so pumped to hear about this movie. It's all anyone's talking about, and I have to plug my ears every time they do.
Unlike the vampires in this film, it definitely will not suck. So we will see you Sunday, May 25th. Bye.
Bye.
All right, let us begin ruining Kaltiki, the immortal monster. We open on a very beautiful black and white set. It's sort of a dim, eerie vista of a square-topped pyramid like you would see in Mexico. And we hear a narrator's voice tell us, "This is the sacred pyramid of the dead city of Tikal, 300 miles south of Mexico City. Here for 1,000 years lived the Mayans, a civilized and peaceful people with a deep-rooted knowledge of mathematics and astronomy." And we sort of pan over those like ivy-covered ruins and sort of these giant stone lizard heads. As we're informed, one day in the year 607 AD, this people immigrated en masse towards the distant wild north, abandoning the sturdy pyramids and temples that they had built. None of the Maya came back, and the jungle slowly swallowed the temples and streets of Tikal. And again, we see the sort of classic Mayan stone lizard heads, because we're going to be playing fast and loose with, like, Kaltiki is not an official deity in the pantheon, but the Maya did have a ton of different gods that we're sort of playing with, and sort of one of their main gods is Kukulkan. The winged serpent god, which also exists sort of similar to other civilizations on the peninsula. It's similar to Quetzalcoatl of the Aztecs, which is also a serpent, winged serpent god. And I think again, we're just spitballing based on what we've found, but sort of the idea of the serpent being of the earth and having wings being of the sky, sort of the union between the two worlds. And so we're seeing a lot of classic Maya architecture. Our narrator informs us the scientific expeditions that tried to shed light on these events were never able to provide a satisfactory explanation. Some believed it must have been an enemy invasion, but what power at the time could have defeated the Mayan people? In the background, Allison, we see a volcano smoking. And it's that beautiful effect in old 50s movies where the smoke, it's like underwater. So they're like smoke underwater. And it's billowing out, but through sort of, it's like waving as if through water.
We really did it right back when everything was practical.
It was very cute. And like, I feel like even the effects that don't really land the plane, they're very endearing and very human. And there are plenty more of them in this movie that I'm excited to tell you about. Because some of them do look like you and I maybe have met it, made them.
Oh, okay.
There were
not great.
The narrator says there were no signs of natural disaster, and what catastrophe could have forced a people to abandon their land and build a new kingdom? Allison, I don't know, perhaps some sort of hideous blob monster that perhaps would do it.
Yes.
The Mayans, they're just like us. The narrator concludes, the mystery remains today, but the nomadic Indians who travel the region say their ancestors fled the land to escape the wrath of a terrible goddess, a bloodthirsty goddess, Kaltiki. Title card, Kaltiki Il Mostro Immortale.
Oh, so a gal.
From a screenplay by Philip Just from a popular ancient Mexican legend. No, I mean, it as much as like, yes, there were many gods.
Yes.
There were goddesses in the Mayan pantheon. This just, as far as I could tell, bears no resemblance, blob-wise or anything like that to any of them. And just, I should say, this is a screenplay by Ricardo Freida, Filippo Sanjust, and there was sort of an argument about who the director was, but made by Mario Bava. So sort of like many of these movies, it seems like the production was a disaster, and there was a lot of conversation about who should be credited, who's actually doing it.
Oh, interesting.
As the credits roll, we see the volcano erupt once again. It's obviously being set off with fireworks, and we hear thunder, beautiful. And we see a volcanic rock tumble away, and behind it emerges into frame a white hand holding a gun, even as it clings to the rock. Yep, that's us, baby. That's exactly, right. We see this man, he's dressed in sort of classic archaeologist wear, big mustache, staggers towards us. A lot of great shot where there's sort of a bright light at his back, and he's staggering through the fog towards us. And he stops and he sees a snake slither into the mouth of a human skull, part of a skeleton half buried in the earth. And I think it's been a minute since I've said this, but boy, you do hate to see it. That would have been enough for me. Horrified, the man staggers on through the dead city of Tikal. And which, again, they keep saying, and it seems rude to say, maybe she's just resting. We don't know her life. We see him emerge onto a stone walkway through the lush dead city. And it's beautiful. It's obviously like, I don't know if it's a matte painting, but it's obviously like a static painting. And then he's sort of like walking along the edge of it. Beautiful, you know, sort of seeing the ruins in the background and the sort of the crumbling stone up front. Stunning. And then he suddenly stumbles up. He's inches away from us. And then he crosses over across the scene we've been watching, and we see this shadow fall on the city. So it's like obviously the back of a set. And I thought it was very
I like that.
It's very endearing. Allison, he stumbles back to the campsite for the archaeology expedition he's a part of, and there are half a dozen men, locals in white, sitting around a campfire, who all leap up at the sight of him. Now, obviously, these are all supposed to be sort of like indigenous locals working at the dig site. This was shot in Italy and France, so I think they're playing pretty fast and loose with casting. Yeah. So they're basically a collection of every actor that this production thought could be in a stone's throw of an indigenous Mexican person. And they're all great in it. And the men leap up when they see this man. He's sweaty, he's wild-eyed, he's holding the gun. And one of them says, "Señor Nieto." And I was like, oh, I wonder what that translates to. And I translate to, it's Google Translate to Mr. Grandson.
Okay.
So it's just his last name is Nieto. Okay. It's not. It has nothing to do with it. But I was like, oh, I do love the, I would watch a movie Mr. named Grandson. Mr. Grandson. That's like the Boss yes. Baby sequel, I suppose. Nieto bursts into a tent and collapses in front of his colleagues, John Fielding, his wife Ellen Fielding, and their coworker Bob. And unfortunately, you could tell because I couldn't find Bob's last name. Bob is not going to make it to the end credits.
Yeah, I don't think so.
And they put Nieto to bed, but he's babbling. He's terrified. His eyes are rolling in his head. He can't tell them what happened. And of course, the other men Ooh. Tend to him. And John Fielding and Bob are joined by their other compatriot, Max Gunther. And Max says, well, what about Ulmer? What happened to him? Nieto is with another man who has not returned with him. And they check Nieto's gun. He has fired every shot. So they're like, uh-oh.
Not good.
Yeah, did our colleague go completely insane and shoot our other colleague on our archaeology dig?
Boy, seems like it.
But, you know, one of the other men is like, well, maybe someone could have attacked them. It's like they were in the caves near the volcano in the abandoned archaeology site. There's nobody else around but us. We had to pay these locals to come with us. Like, it's like, this is not a populated area. And but it's like, ooh, they went to the cave near the volcano. Oh, in the dead city of Tikal. I probably wouldn't have done that. And they're like, oh, they're sort of arguing. It's like, okay, it was an accident. Maybe Nieto hit Ulmer, you know. And he's like, well, he certainly wouldn't have attacked him. They're like brothers. Like, what could have happened down there? And Bob says, oh, great. I can see the headlines now. Two archaeologists duel in the Tikal caves in Mexico. And one of the men, our protagonist, Dr. John Fielding, says, shut the fuck up, Bob. We have to go to the cave because Ulmer could be wounded and we need to go help him. So whatever happened, we have to go find out. We can't just abandon him. And at the sound of the name Ulmer, Nieto sort of wakes up in his bed and says, Ulmer, the mummy, the mummy. And I said, oh, okay. A mummy.
Interesting.
And then he cries out, Kel-tiki, Kel-tiki. And he passes out. Always a great sign.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And Max Gunther says,
Kel-tiki. Kel-tiki è una divinità maya.
Unfortunately, Nieto is out for the count. So they decide they're going to set off for the caves to look for Ulmer. And we leave. John Fielding leaves his wife, Ellen, to watch after Nieto. Allison, everyone is like, they're fully in tents. It's very classic Indiana Jones, like archaeology, you know what I mean? Like sleeping in tents, you know, there's maps everywhere. And then Ellen Fielding steps out. And again, she is our star. She is a stunning woman played by Dee Dee Perrigo.
Okay.
And she steps out and she's got full beat cat eyeliner. This is an Italian production.
I mean,
like that where you the look where you do hot rollers and then you brush it out.
Yes.
So it's like smooth but really poofy, and then hard nipples under a white shirt.
Wow.
And she's like,
that
what's going on?
That is a fucking look.
And I'm like, that is the wife of an archaeologist as we know her and see her. She's joined by her local companion, sort of her, you know, sort of assistant slash handmaiden, I suppose, Linda. She is a local. And they all roll out, and Linda says, do you think they'll find him? And Ellen says, I don't know. I fear something horrible has happened. We, of course, know from the title that she is correct.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of this where we know of like, ooh, there's some kind of immortal monster they're headed towards.
Yeah.
We don't know this yet. Linda says, well, that's how the Indians feel, too, the men in the camp. They're terrified. They say we shouldn't have come here and provoked the spirits. And it's like, ooh, yeah, you probably shouldn't have done that either.
Yeah. And whenever anybody gives you that feedback, like, that's right.
Yeah, no, we should have come here.
You shouldn't have.
Yeah. she Ellen Linda tells Ellen, I'm afraid that the men will abandon us if we don't leave soon. So this is not a great sign, because I think that they're kind of itching to leave anyways. Ellen says, I'll tell John when he gets back, but you know it's pointless. He doesn't listen to me. And again, they check in on Nieto. He's delirious. He keeps repeating the same name over and over again. Tate McRae. No, I'm kidding. It's Cal Tiki. It's Cal Tiki, Allison. We see the men with torches entering the mouth of the cave. However, it's gigantic. I mean, this is like 40 feet tall, and they're going in all these different like ante rooms. They cannot find Ulmer or Ulmer's body anywhere. Instead, they find a Mayan mural sort of engraved into the wall, and beneath it what looks to be a new opening in the rock. And they're familiar with these caves, so sure. Dr. Fielding's like, oh my god, the eruption of the volcano the other day must have opened up a gap in the floor and revealed this doorway to us. And of course, Al said, better wedge ourselves immediately inside of it. Like,
yes, I think
say.
It's best when you see a new hole in a cave to pursue what's get in there.
Have you seen, there's a lot of TikToks, videos on TikTok of people making fun of cave divers?
Oh, no, I haven't seen those. I was, okay, go ahead.
What were you going to say?
I was thinking about the woman who was like building a mine underneath her house.
Oh, yeah. What happened with her? I saw that. I was like, I don't need to see more.
I forgot, and I didn't follow it because I was like, I don't care if this woman lives or dies. Like,
takes all kinds. I hope like, she's well, but I didn't think. Yeah.
But it was like she was like building a, like an intense like mine underneath her house. Like nothing was regulated. Nothing was cleared. She was doing it by herself.
Yeah, because the lawn would collapse on top of me.
Right. Like, but I guess her next project, because she was like taking every stone out of the ground and like saving it. And now she's going to build a castle with rocks. it's like, whatever, girl.
What were you going to say? This is just one of those things right here that I'm like, I guess I'm glad I'm single, because if that was my wife, I think I'd have a hard time with
it. Yeah. How do you even be like, hey, could you stop building a mine under our house?
What's going on back there?
If you're going to build a mine under our house, could you not do it alone?
Let's go take like, salsa lessons. You know what I mean?
Yeah. How about a cooking class? Making fun of cave divers.
Yes. People are constantly making fun of cave divers for... Unfortunately, there are some tales of cave divers getting stuck sort of in incredibly small crevasses.
Yes.
And it's sort of like, you know, anytime a cave diver sees like, you know, a hole that a mouse has made in the wall, they're going to try to swim into it. And then watching this, it's like, yeah, my instinct in skiing this would not be, we have to go down there.
No.
Like, it makes my throat close up.
Pretty anxious already. Yeah,
Allison, which is of course what I call both of us, so I remember. They look into the crevasse, and there's actually steps down in the darkness. So there's something below them that somebody has taken the time to carve wooden steps down into. They also bring a Geiger counter in case there's radiation. I was like, oh, that's good. I hadn't thought about that. That's smart.
Yeah.
Do they have some sort of blob detector while they're at it?
Right, that's going to be a bigger problem for them.
They're going to want one for sure. Yeah. Everything looks okay radiation-wise, so they all descend the stairs, and they find an underground pool. And above it, a gigantic sculpture of the Mayan goddess Kaltiki, who again doesn't exist. So it's sort of like your generic goddess, you know, sort of a gigantic woman headdress. Bob is thrilled because this is obviously an underground temple. You know, they carved the stairs. There's a gigantic statue to her. This is not just a random hole in the ground, right? Unfortunately, back at camp, they don't know this, but starts going, Kaltiki. So probably Ulmer is down in that room somewhere based on his reaction.
Yes.
And we see the Geiger counter starts jumping. Radiation has been detected, and they think the radiation is coming from the underground pool. Max Gunther says, this must be the pool where priests drown the victims they sacrifice to the goddess.
Okay.
Now my question was, does that explain the radiation? Is that what we're saying?
Like, that's not like, I'm no scientist, but even I know that dead bodies don't become radioactive over time, no matter what religion.
Yes. That being said, there is a in the Yucatan Peninsula, the Maya people did use, and I'm gonna try to process, it's a cenote or cenote, C-E-N-O-T-E. It's a natural sinkhole filled with water, in collapsed limestone, and they did sometimes make sacrificial offerings, and they did throw people in it.
Sure.
So that's actually based in where, you know, who it's for. We're creating a Celtigi. The tradition, it is based in reality. So I see that part less so. Yes. Why that would be creating radiation.
Not the radiation.
But they're thinking, okay, maybe Elmer fell in. That maybe Nieto freaked out, and Bob's like, oh, I should have brought my underwater gear again. Bob's prepared but not prepared enough. Unfortunately, all of a sudden they find Ulmer's camera right next to the water's edge, and the lens is cracked. So they're like, okay, his body's probably, he must have fallen in. We must go back to camp and get our diving gear. We can come back and retrieve his body. Again, Dr. Fielding is the one who's like, we can't leave him here. We owe it to his family. We just have to go and fish him out. And they all file out, and the last person out is one of the indigenous men, and he lights a second torch and he throws it into the water, and we see it illuminate on the far side in the shadow. There is a collection of mummified bodies, ostensibly those either people who have been sacrificed in the water, or people who have visited this temple in the past and did not make it out alive. They return to camp, and Nieto's actually doing worse. He has a fever and it's rising, so they start like making plans like, okay, we're gonna have to get him out of here. Like, do we have to have somebody fly in? It's the 50s, you know, so it's like, okay, this is gonna be a multi-day project to get this guy out of here. Meanwhile, Bob develops the film in Ulmer's camera, because and all the white people go into one tent to set up a projector to watch the film strip. And we see Nieto and Ulmer earlier in the day, and Ellen says, who's filming this? And it was one of their Indian guides, but he accompanied them to the cave's mouth and went no further. And apparently the men already questioned him. He doesn't know anything. He's like, I didn't go into the cave. When Nieto came out, I saw him then. We see Nieto and Ulmer walking around the edge of the volcano, which is still smoking. So it's not dangerous. Like, they can get close enough, but it's still actively insanely hot. And we see Ulmer filming Nieto inside the Celtigi temple. So we see Nieto going down the steps, and he climbs up onto the statue and he finds a golden bracelet. So I think this is the first time at least Bob is like, oh, so there might be some kind of treasure of some sort. Allison, suddenly in the film strip, the camera begins to wobble. Ulmer is being attacked from behind, and we see Nieto, who's terrified, pull out his gun and start firing at something behind Ulmer.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we see the camera drop to the floor and the film goes dark. Outside, the locals start beating drums and singing. This is what a Italian-French production, again, thinks would be what an indigenous Mexican group of men is doing. So you can imagine. Inside their tent, Ellen says, these people are driving me crazy. I should have never come here. It's like, well, not with that attitude, Ellen.
Yeah.
These people. She says to John, this was supposed to be a second honeymoon. This is very clearly a work trip.
Yeah.
This is actually you're the middle of the jungle.
Yeah, nothing about this says honeymoon.
Yeah, he's very quite busy.
Everything says archaeological dig.
But I mean, I understand you're disappointed. You're on this trip.
Sure.
One of your husband's coworkers has potentially died. The other is insane.
Yes.
And so of course you pick a fight. And she says, I've asked you to take me away for years, but all you care about is work. I am leaving for Mexico City tomorrow. And Dr. Fielding says, then go. I'm not going to force you to stay here, even though you're my wife.
Okay.
Outside, Max Gunther overhears their fight. And I'll take a smoke break. And he's sort of overhearing their disagreement. Nell says, well, you don't care about me at all. And Dr. Fielding says, I have duties, responsibility, and probably some blob-related tasks headed my way. He's like, look, we made an important discovery today. And Ellen makes a point where she's like, the discovery is one man is dead and the other is dying. That's what you've discovered so far. And if you can't see that part, then maybe I should just leave. Dr. Philly says that's all the more reason to carry on. At least they won't have died for nothing if we actually find something here. Ellen storms out to smoke, and Max follows her into the underbrush. Meanwhile, Bob is watching the locals singing and drumming. And she tells him, okay, it's a spell to placate the anger of evil spirits. So obviously they're picking up bad vibes from the Celtigi temple. They see Nieto. They're picking up something's bad wrong. And the locals start dancing, and Bob grabs Linda's hand and says, oh, a sacred dance. I got to go see this. And Linda yanks her hand away and stops him and says, a white person can't join the ritual. It brings bad luck. Again, yes, that yes. is us. That is, yes. that's fair.
Yes.
And Bob says, not me. And then goes down anyway. So he like goes down this hill to watch the locals dance. It's like, all right, Bob. Unfortunately, Bob, right here, Bob does not know. He does not have a last name in the in this movie. So not he doesn't know that world. He could die at any point.
Yes. Yeah.
And we see him. He's at least having the decency to sit the sort of discreetly in the underbrush as the locals play the drums and sing. And then an Indian woman starts dancing. She emerges from the trees and does, again, what I would call a very 1959 Italian take on what an indigenous woman might be wearing and doing during okay. such a dance.
Sure.
She tears off. She's sort of like has like a white top and like a sort of a striped calf-length skirt, and she tears off her skirt to reveal a smaller sort of torn Flintstone style ripped version of the same skirt.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I'm like, I don't hate it, no. But it just is like, okay.
I don't know if I get it.
And it goes on for a very long time, and at a certain point you could tell that she is improvising quite a yeah. bit. And that is, again, perhaps she's, I don't know what kind of dance she studied, but it was not improv indigenous dance, I'll tell you that much.
Sure. Well, most people don't have that skill.
Bob looks on, and Ellen also watches from the underbrush, smoking, and Max sort of sidles up to her. Max says, I'm so sorry about what you're going through with John. Ellen says, well, what do you mean? And Max tries to backtrack. He's like, I just heard you two arguing. I heard what John said, and I think he's behaving horribly. Ellen says, well, I thought you were John's friend. Max says, well, of course I am, but I'm fond of you too, and I'd like to see you happy. It's like, okay. Max tells Ellen, a woman shouldn't live like this. You're a sensitive creature. You need warmth and affection. And Ellen's like, I think maybe you took that conversation a little too seriously. We had an argument, but it wasn't the end of the world. And Max says, perhaps, but I hope one day you'll seek refuge in my arms. Allison, what would you do?
What would you do?
I mean, I think I'd be like, you finish your work trip. I'm going home.
Yes.
That would be my, like, overall.
100%. Would you tell your husband that his colleague pretty much, invited you to seek refuge in his arms? Would you tell him that?
I would hold on to that.
Okay.
And see how the rest of the trip goes.
And again, there's going to be a blob monster you're going to have to contend with. So this is really just sort of maybe a subsidiary issue, a love triangle.
Yes.
But I did think, now this is the kind of action adventure I am looking for in this movie.
Yes, absolutely. Give us a love triangle. Give us a fleeing spouse, a new lover.
However,
an immortal blob.
Allison, Ellen makes it clear that she's not interested, because she turns to Max and says, don't kid yourself, Max. And then tells him goodnight before going to bed. Okay. So at least you got to be direct. You're in the middle of the jungle. You got to be direct with your husband's coworkers.
Yeah. None of this vague, blurred lines.
My concern now, of course, is Max going to feed Dr. John Fielding to Kaltiki, the immortal monster, so that he might possess his beautiful wife, Ellen. Let's find out.
Fresh air, sunshine, and good food. That is what spring is all about. And HelloFresh makes it easy to fit quick home-cooked meals into your schedule every week by curating delicious recipes like pasta primavera, chicken Dijon, and peanut-crusted trout, as well as over 100 seasonal snacks, sides, and treats.
In 2025, they're evolving to fit every lifestyle by bringing customers even more convenience without compromising on taste, health, or homemade quality. Their new ready-made meals offer chef-crafted, flavorful dishes that are ready in just 3 minutes, so you can dig in and get outside, get work done, or just get some me time.
Every HelloFresh meal uses high-quality ingredients, including seasonal, fresh produce, and proteins that travel from the farm to your doorstep, with flexible deliveries that you can pause or skip whenever you need. We have done HelloFresh. We have been using HelloFresh. I am loving HelloFresh right now. It has been such a savior to me, as I'm, like, a little bored with the recipes that I personally know, and I'm ready for something that's, like, healthy and also, like, a real meal.
I agree. I got a couple things that I wouldn't normally have gotten on my own, because I thought, why not? For example, example, I got the sweet Thai chili pork tenderloin with zesty rice. I've never cooked pork before. The instructions are really easy. It turned out really delicious. It's enough cooking to make it feel like you're doing something, but at the same time, it's easy enough that it feels like you're not, which I really liked.
Yes, I did the like saucy beef burrito bowl, and it was so nice to just like make a meal and then have like a full other meal ready for me tomorrow, because it was like, it's too, like, I'm one person, so like when I get that, it's like 2 to 3 servings, and like it was so nice to be like, oh, I had a delicious meal, and then I was like, and now I have a delicious lunch for tomorrow, and it was wonderful and healthy and filling and really, really perfect. So feel great with meals that fit your spring schedule and make the season even more delicious. Go to HelloFresh.com/ruined10FM now and get your 10 free meals with a free item for life. One per box with active subscription. Free meals applied as a discount on the first box. New subscribers only. Varies by plan.
Meanwhile, Linda has overheard Max's overtures to Ellen. She sidles up to Max and says, oh, is that how you hoped to conquer that little millionaire's doll? Linda says, you're aiming a little too high. And Max turns on and says, so are you. I haven't been able to get rid of you since I pulled you out of that third-rate joint. Linda obviously it does have some affection for Max. And as it turns out, the rest of the movie, we'll see that she is, in fact, in love with him. So she's hurt by this.
Okay.
She says, you have no right to treat me like this. You promised. And Max turns to her and says, men promise all sorts of things to a woman like you. And I'm sure I'm not the first. And she raises her arm to slap him, but he grabs her hand. And she says, it's true. I've never hidden my past from you, but you won't get rid of me that easily. I don't want to lose you, Max. And Max looks her in the face and says, if you're looking for a husband, take me off the list. Find yourself a half-breed like yourself. Cal Tiki out
here. Yeah, let's get that blob in here.
If your man want to get buck wild, Cal Tiki is going to hit him up style. I need Cal Tiki to roll out here right now. Unfortunately, Linda is down bad, and this does not put an end to their relationship, though of course it should.
Of course.
Meanwhile, the Indian woman continues to dance, and now Bob's got his camera out. He's taking photos of it, which it'd be bad enough he was trying to dance. It's even worse that he's taking images of it. Yep.
Yeah.
And the men are drumming and calling, and another woman sort of dancing. And I don't know much dance terminology, but the dancer is just on the ground going full Kristen Wiig with it, just sort of kicking her legs wildly like a little potato bug.
Very Elaine.
It's very Elaine. But suddenly she sits up and she screams, and everyone stops playing and turns, and they see Bob in the underbrush. So again, bad luck. Get out of here. And we see Bob locks eyes with the dancer, and then he just recedes into the trees like that Homer Simpson meme of Homer Simpson retreating into the bush. That night, Ellen wakes in bed and she calls to John and wakes him up and says, will you forgive me? And he goes to her. They're on separate little twin cots, and he apologizes to She says, well, he says, well, both of our nerves are in shreds, obviously, unfortunately. And he says, well, you know, I think a good argument every now and again is key to a happy marriage. And what about a Cal Tiki the Immortal Monster every now and again? Does she help her hurt a marriage?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say, probably hurt. But maybe cleans things up a little bit, makes it obvious what
really
matters, what you should be up
to. That's true. And Ellen says, yeah, I'm sorry. I know I'm moody, but you knew that before you married me. He's like, oh, I know. And you know, I'm obsessed with my work, but that won't be forever. It's just right now, you know, with this project. And he says, look, tomorrow we're going to get back to our research, but I know you actually want to leave, and I want you to do whatever you want. So I'll make sure you and Linda get back to Mexico City right away. And she says, do you want that? And he's basically like, honestly, I'd really prefer it. Things have really taken a turn here. So, you know, with all the insane shit that's happening now, and we don't even know whether there's a blob monster. So I would send you back, Linda, back tomorrow. And she says, okay. And of course, they kiss, passionate kiss goodnight. And the next thing you know, she and Linda head off back to Mexico City. And the expedition is lowering Bob and his scuba gear into the Cal Tiki Lake with a rope. And he looks up at the sculpture. He says, I don't like her, but I wore protection. And he shows off. He is. I couldn't tell if it was a cross or a saint's medal, but he has some sort of golden.
Some kind of religious jewelry.
And he descends into the pool. Allison, when he gets to this pool is, I don't know, 50 feet deep. I thought that we were talking like 15 feet, 20 feet. This is basically an underwater ocean.
No.
Allison.
Too deep.
At the bottom, he finds a skeleton after skeleton. And then all of them are draped in beautiful treasures. You know, golden necklaces, crowns. Like, they were obviously adorned before they were sacrificed. And so he's like, okay.
Oh, stuff.
He yanks the rope. They pull him to the surface. He tells everybody. And he grabbed one of the necklaces off a skeleton. Says, we're rich. He says, we're going to be billionaires. I was like, damn, how much was jewelry back then? Damn.
Yeah, what, to have like a bunch of gold?
And Max examines the necklace. He's like, that makes sense. They would have, again, adorned the bodies, adorned them before they threw them in, but still no sign of Ulmer. So they did not find what seemed to be his body down there, because these bodies looked all pretty ancient, right? Bob wants to go down and do at least one more time and look for him, but also to scoop up more treasure. So he gets sort of like a big mesh bag. And John's hesitant, like, I don't know if it's really worth this risk, but Bob insists. He goes down with his underwater grave robbing bag that luckily he packed.
Yes, thank God.
And on the surface, John's like, I don't want him to stay down there so long. Allison, it is already too late, because we see Bob hit the floor and start collecting more jewelry, and he looks up and we see his horrified face through his scuba mask. Great shot. As something attacks him under the water.
Oh, under the water.
So he's under the water. Something is rushing up to him. And the team feels the rope jerk and they haul Bob to the surface. Unfortunately, when he hits the surface, he is unconscious. And when they pull his mask off, his face has been dissolved away as if by acid. So he has eyeballs, but he has no lip. Ooh. He's grinning skeleton teeth. One of the men screams, look out, senor. And all the local men haul ass out of there. And as John and Max turn around, we see the edge of a gigantic blob monster emerge from the pool.
Man, how does it move in the water? Must be real
weird.
We
don't see it. And I think it would, much like a duck, I bet it's much more elegant in water. But unfortunately, we don't see it. Yeah. Imagine a pair of jeans swimming on their own. It's sort of what I was imagining.
Okay.
Or probably jean shorts, because it is sort of oblong. It's not long. It's like round.
Right. Yeah.
Again, a deflated basketball is the general shape. John and Max turn to flee, but Max says, wait, we left the bag full of jewels. Allison... hubris.
Guys, this greed will be the end of you.
And when Max runs into the bag, he trips and he falls head first into Kaltiki, the immortal monster. And she hates that.
Ugh, she knows she hates that.
And his arm goes into her, basically. So he's fallen in such a way that his arm has penetrated the blob. And it looks like, and again, these are all practical effects. It's obviously a puppet that somebody is like operating that's like the size of like, I don't know, a large cat. Let's say it's the size of Riz, and somebody has his hand in it. It says it looks like a wet, deflated basketball made out of velvet. It's not a traditional blob, but because it's obviously a solid material, they made the blob. But it's actually kind of effective. Like it's kind of stiff, but at the same time, like moves like a slug. And
The images in the trailer, I'm like, this works.
Yeah,
like,
they got me.
I'm on board.
Yeah, and also, like, not every blob has to be wet like Jell-O. I appreciate it. Like and also, maybe underwater it is more of a jellyfish, but it has to crawl on surface because it sort of collapsed on itself. I bought it. Allison, Kaltiki sucks Max's arm in to its elbow. And unfortunately, it also scars his face badly. It has some sort of acid mucus on top of it that starts to dissolve your skin. Fortunately, they also packed an axe.
Is the whole surface of it acid?
Yes. I think we're to think...
like if you touched anywhere on it, it would be...
yes. I think we're to think that it is corrosive to the human skin. And so John's able to grab it with an axe and starts hacking away at the blob, cutting off a piece of it. But then obviously the blob is still enrobing Max's arm. But luckily he's able to pull Max free and haul him out of the cave. Some of the locals are waiting and he sort of dumps Max in front of him. But he says, do not touch what's on his arm. It's dangerous. Please don't touch it. Thinking fast, John runs to a nearby gasoline depot, as evidenced by a sign that says danger gasoline. Allison, okay. He hops in a gasoline truck and he drives that fucker straight into the caves at Tikal, as Kaltiki is about to emerge from the mouth of the cave. Allison, John dives free at the last second, and we see the truck, which is now a little toy truck, slam into what is obviously like a paper mache 3D model of a cave and explode into flames. And we see from John's perspective, Kaltiki shrivel up and burn and sort of like desiccate and decay, right?
So like, we got her.
Yeah. So at least it's killable with fire. And so we know that he's a very smart person. He's got it up here. Yeah. They're able to get Max out of surgery, and they are able to remove the bit of Kaltiki from his arm. However, Allison, and here it looks like theater curtains dipped in paper mache liquid, glittery but stiff, pliable and wet, that's being pulled away, revealing a thick sort of glue-like mucus fluid bonding it to Max's arm. Allison, when they pull the blob off of Max's forearm, there is nothing left but bone. So they have gloves on, and they're able to handle it with gloves.
Okay.
But I think we're to think if it touches you, it just starts burning you, because I think it's dissolving you to eat you. So I guess it's like how flies like vomit onto food to dissolve it to eat it.
Yes.
So that's what I took it as. Okay. And unfortunately, it has eaten his entire forearm but the bone. And
that makes sense.
We see the nurse pull the put the blob into a plastic bin. So I guess it can't eat plastic, thank God. I mean, I guess it evolved before plastic, I suppose.
Yes, right. It doesn't know how much plastic there is now.
If it could eat plastic, my God, our entire civilization is over. Oh yeah, that's true. Also, we could befriend it. I guess it would just keep getting larger and larger is the problem, though, because this is a little guy. Again, like this is probably the size of Riz, right? But it's still, and luckily it's inert right now. It's not moving. And the nurse brings the blob over to John and the surgeon. And the surgeon says, well, thank God, if you'd brought him in an hour later, we couldn't have done anything for him. Which I'm like, are you a blob expert? What do you mean an hour?
Right. It's like, everybody knows that immortal acid covered dissolves your skin blobs. You know, an hour is where things really start to go. Like, what?
Yeah, it's like rattlesnake venom.
Yeah.
And John says, can you save him? And the surgeon says, look, I'm going to be totally honest with you. An unknown being has entered his arm and absorbed all the vital fluids out of it. I'm going to need your help as a talented biologist. I was like, oh, he's a biologist. I thought he was an archaeologist. But he says, I need you to find the origin of the blob. So I think I could save him, but I don't know enough information to know what this is or sort of what to do. And I think it's fun because it's like, oh, okay, so now John's going to go on a journey of learning. And also it gives him something to do.
Yeah.
So John takes the blob to his laboratory at work. And he has other members of the scientific community take a look at it. And there's a professor that's sort of his main professor. Professor, I believe, Rodriguez takes a look at it. Yes, Professor Rodriguez, sort of his mentor, takes a look at it. And John says, it's not a known organism. It's a fraction of an animal that I believe is just one giant cell. And they look at it under the microscope. It's like, see, it doesn't have cells.
One
it is a
giant cell.
And they're like, but this would have taken millennia to form. Like, this is the idea that, like, okay, if cells, let's say, you know, like millions of years ago, cells were forming. We are multi-celled organisms. They sort of joined together and started evolving.
Yeah.
This would imply that this took a different path, where instead of combining, something allowed it to become a gigantic one-celled organism. What could have done that? Right?
Right.
And so he asks the professor, is there a way to establish its age? And the professor says, oh, yes, thank God. Luckily, we have a computer. And we go into a room, and it's a gigantic room-sized computer.
Yes, computers used to be.
It's incredible. Huge. And obviously, to see that for the first time must have been so, like, it does fill you with awe. And it's shot with that kind of awe. Like, you won't fucking believe what we can do with this bitch. And he says, this is a result of 20 years of work. And part of me is like, ooh, we should have stopped then. You had to go to a room, put in your data, and then you get to go home.
Yeah.
Or just stop at the desktop.
I will say, the desktop computer is where we should have stopped.
Right, because it doesn't take up the whole room, but you leave it in a room. So
you can come and go and engage with it, but it's not like, I must live my whole life tied to this piece of electronics.
Yeah, I saw this tweet where someone's like, oh, people always said that about technology, like, oh, the printing press, oh, computers. And I'm like, oh, and then basically like, oh, like ChatGPT is not it's not going to be any worse than that. It's like, you have, what are we basing this on?
Yeah, like,
why is it
not the printing press?
Right,
it's not the printing press.
And also
the printing press doesn't have the ability to learn.
And also, like, the printing press did change the world. It's just that we live, so yeah, we have such an ahistoric idea of what that means, and now it's like, right, well, this is going to change the world. It's just like, you're pretending because the printing press was good, ergo this is good. That's not how reality, yes, works, you know.
No
fortunately, they are able to use a computer to do carbon dating to find out the relative age of anything, even a living, okay, being. So they take the blob and they put it essentially on like a, like, it looks like a self-checkout car, like you just put it in its bin on top of like a Xerox, sure, machine that like looks at it. The scale goes off the goddamn charts, and the professor's assistant says, no, this can't be, this is saying the cell must be 20 million years old. Allison, we see the headlines and we're seeing physical newspapers like this.
Oh, I love, know, that
prehistoric creature still alive, biologist's incredible discovery, a billion year being found into call, Professor Fielding holds scientific conference. And I was like, ooh, Max is gonna die, like something bad's, he's gonna turn into the lob or something. Max is not like,
yeah,
this is not,
no,
something that a human can go up against. And we see John holds a scientific conference to like tell the scientific community about this, and we see him in like a spiffy white suit talking to a room full of science heavy hitters. And he said, you know, initially we went on our expedition to find potential reasons why for the Maya's migration in 607 AD. But we believe that we've discovered a prehistoric creature from the early geological eras. And we found above the doorway to its temple, the temple where it was in the pool, it says, and we translated it, Kaltiki is one and immortal. When her bridegroom comes from the sky, the power of Kaltiki will destroy the world.
The sky? Yeah.
You hate to read it. When her bridegroom, okay, comes from the sky, the power of Kaltiki will destroy the world. As you can imagine, this sends the room abuzz with this reveal. And he says, you know, we actually have a bit of Kaltiki with us, which I am now studying. Allison... John arrives, mm-hmm, at home. So this is like a couple days later. Ellen is already home with Linda, and they have a toddler daughter named Jenny, who's adorable. And Jenny runs over and says, Papa. And then she grabs at his valise, like his luggage, like a kid would. And he sort of like moves her away and he says, never let her into the office. And Ellen says, excuse me, what are you talking about? And she has the nanny take Jenny upstairs. And Ellen finds John unpacking the Kaltiki sample in his,
right,
office,
sure,
which,
sure,
is a lab. Like, it's a full lab in their,
why,
house. But she's like, why did you keep it? Why didn't you destroy it? You know what it became. And John's basically like, oh, because of, yes, my immense and overweening pride. Obviously, I think I could bring it into my home and it doesn't blow up my house and destroy my family. It's obviously going to do that. Well,
I mean, if you're going to have it, it should be in like a giant protected, like not just in your home office.
Allison, he keeps this thing in a glass container on his, essentially, no, the big like science table. It doesn't have a lock on it. There's nothing even on top of it, like a big rock.
Right. Put a book up there.
Ladies, if he brings a piece of Kaltiki, the immortal monster, into your home while your kids are running around, oh, that's a deal breaker.
That's a deal breaker.
Kids will drink bleach from under the sink. Like, why the f-
oh,
you have,
yeah,
an entity
20 million year old deadly blob
that all it wants to do is dissolve human flesh and consume it to become huge. But then we see it.
And you're keeping it in a Tupperware in your office?
Basically.
At home?
And we see him pick it up and transfer it to the container. And it looks like, again, it fully looks like a pair of wet jeans. Like I remember, yeah, I'm trying to remember, like, they're like bedazzled jeans that are soaking wet. Like, sort of, there,
sure,
was an era of bedazzled jeans that
yeah,
Kaltiki really would have enjoyed. Ellen says, how is Max? Because Max is still at the hospital recovering. And John says, well, he's actually not doing well. He's getting worse. And that's another reason I need to study this, is like, if I can figure out what, like, more information, maybe I can help them stop this from killing him. Because while he is alive, he is slowly starting to degrade.
Yeah.
And again, it's like, mostly it's my hubris making me do this, but also this might be our only hope to save Max. So they're going to try him. They go to the, yeah, hospital to see Max. Ellen looks cunt. She's literally like,
what's she wearing?
Like, you know, like blonde, curly blowout, strands of pearls, a cinched little waist in an all-white outfit. Incredible.
Love that.
And Linda, who is also stunning, is standing watch. Linda has, of course, been spending all of her time in the hospital taking care of Max, who insulted her to her face in a variety of ways, including in a racist way. And she tells them he regained consciousness, but I'll be honest, he's been acting very strange. He'll scream in pain and then he'll laugh and his arm, oh. John goes in to see Max and Ellen takes Linda to go sit and sort of calm her down. And she asks Linda, would you want to come stay with me and John until Max is well enough to go home? And Linda says, yes, please. In the room, Max is awake, but he is acting oddly. And he says, well, how's Nieto? And John's like, oh, Mr. Grandson, he's doing well. He's expected back to work in a few days. And Max says, you were always a bad liar. He's dead, isn't he? And John says, yes. It's like, okay, well, we was going to figure it out. If he lives, he was going to figure it out. So okay. Why lie to him?
Yeah.
I guess it was the 50s. John says, yes, he did die, but you will survive. And Max screams, look at my arm. And he holds it up. Look at my face. And he has scars from where he fell on top of Kaltiki. He says, I know what's going to happen. You're going to use me as a guinea pig in your little science experiments about this thing.
Vedrai, faremo l'impossibile. Ah, certo. Certo, mi userete come cavia e morrò anch'io come gli altri. Che pazzia fu andare in quella grotta. Vedrai tu come la pagheremo cara. Tutti quanti. Tutti quanti.
And of course, the nurse runs in to give Max a sedative. You know when you scream, all of us, in a hospital, and they have to sedate you?
Yes, yes. Yeah. They're like, let's get some Dilaudid in here.
John meets with his doctor, who says, okay, so I'm going to be honest, we are in uncharted territory because of the whole Kaltiki of it all. And he says, the problem is it looks like a third-degree burn, but the tissue feels like parchment. The skin looks like it's been, and John says, mummified. The doctor says, yes, and it looks like it happened very quickly. So basically, the Kaltiki like draws all the fluids out of your body and starts to mummify you immediately, which is why there are all these mummies. You know, they weren't going to decay.
Okay.
They had no liquid in them. The doctor says it's even worse than it looks because I believe the poison has entered the bloodstream. And unfortunately, sooner or later, it will enter his brain and it will kill him. Allison, we see much like how Max was listening in on Ellen and John's spat. He's listening on the other side of the door and hearing the doctor give his very bad diagnosis, Kaltiki, the immortal monster. And then the doctor ends the conversation. Yeah. He says, ah, well, and then shakes John's hand and leaves, which I guess it was the 50s. That's probably how doctors said it. But at home, John, he's our rock. He's our protagonist. He really does believe that he can save Max. So he's furiously studying Kaltiki. And we see him. And it's a montage of him opening books, looking at it, looking at graphs. And it's like all these unrelated things. And we hear his voiceover like, if we accept this is a million-year-old primordial cell, amoebas have a similar structure. Primitive unicellular beings developed by combining with similar organisms. This one must have gotten bigger without combining, but what natural biological force could have caused this development? So again, like most amoebas can't naturally get the size to become the size of a Toyota Corolla. It's just not going to get there. What could have caused this? Ellen comes in, tells him it's almost one. Do you want to come to bed? And John says, I will soon. I just can't grasp the nature of this. Like I'm missing something. Like how could this have happened? Why does it destroy everything it touches? And Ellen's like, I don't know. Good luck. And she goes to bed.
Yeah.
And the voiceover, we see Johnny's like looking at this graph of amoebas. And he says, but what if, could it be? In the morning, he's in his robe. He makes a call to the professor. And he says, what if the caves were right below the volcano? The volcano had just erupted, and we did sense gamma radiation in the caves. Could it be the exploding of a volcano? That's the creature's energy source. So maybe it sort of reawakened with the eruption of the volcano. So that's where it's getting its energy, its radioactivity. But of course, we won't know it until we subject it to an electron bombardment. And boy, who has something working we could do that? And the professor's like, you won't believe this. Bring it later today and I'll have the Betatron ready to go.
Great.
And thank God they have a computer and a Betatron ready to go. Thank God. And thank God they weren't doing anything with either of them. So we can just get you in right away.
Yeah.
Allison, we see him. He divides, for reasons that are just movie related, John divides up the blob and puts most of it into a carrying container, but leaves a little chunk of it behind just in case at his house. So in case, I guess, the Betatron destroys it, he wants to keep a little bit. And John goes to the Betatron and he tests the frag with the professor. And as they watch the Betatron hit it with the Betatron laser, obviously, we see it looks like a disgusting dog blanket, or like our dogs growing up would always steal, like, whatever blanket the dogs took over. They just took over the blanket.
Became disgusting.
And for us, it was always like our once we had grown out of sleeping bags, the sleeping bag was too small. It was the dog's blanket. And so this is
absolutely.
It's sort of like they're watching it. It's still in the container. It starts to foam and twitch. So it's like rolling and moving around and bubbling and growing. And it's obviously a puppeteer that someone is pushing up against it from under the table. But I thought they did a dynamite job. It's very gross. The moisture and the foam really add to it.
The moisture and the foam.
And it looks like it's like about to cleave in half. And John says to the professor, I believe that with even greater radioactivity, this will grow bigger. It could even reproduce. So if it
So stop.
I concur. Allison, in his hospital bed, we see Max, who is actually much quieter and subdued and contrite. And Max says to Linda, you're so kind to me. You're so nice to me, even though I'm just a specimen now. And I'm just one of John's specimen. Linda says that he's just trying to help you. I promise you. Like, he called the professor. Like, everyone is trying to figure out how to help you. And obviously I'm here fucking day and night, bitch. And he waves her off. He says, no, they've exploited me for my work way too long. They're going to have to deal with me as I am now, including that woman who dared spurn me. She'll regret it. And Linda says, don't talk about that. I'm here with you. Don't fucking talk about another woman. Allison, Max starts laughing maniacally and he turns to her. And boy, the acid burn on his face looks worse than ever. And he says, no, now I'm stronger than any of them. They'll all see. And you're better off by my side. Allison, who will survive this movie?
Who will survive?
Who have we got? We've got Max.
So, we've got Max, who just screamed, they'll all see. Not a great sign. Obviously.
Linda,
and then we have
wife.
Linda. Yes. What do we think about Linda? Is Linda going to make it?
I think no. And I think Max also no.
And then what about John and Ellen and then their daughter, Jenny, who is a toddler?
Oh, God. Maybe Ellen and Jenny survive.
Okay, great.
John does
and
not.
Yeah, we also have the professor, the professor and the professor's assistant.
Let's get the body count up. I say all of them.
And I'm going ahead and confirm the professor does die. You're not surprised. Once you see this character, you're like, that guy's going to die.
Yep.
And he dies in a way that I absolutely loved because it was just like, oh, okay.
Yep. All right.
So again, ladies, if he screams in his hospital bed about how they'll all see and talks about another woman in front of you,
that's a deal breaker.
Allison, Linda, who's devastated by this conversation, obviously leaves for the night and goes back to Ellen and John's home to sleep. Unfortunately, in the dead of night, when the night nurse comes to make her rounds, she finds Max's bed empty, and then she turns around and Max clobbers her from behind and then beats the nurse to death in a deranged rage.
What?
So I guess what do you think? Like, he's losing his mind and he's becoming hyper violent, and that's the influence of Cal Tiki.
Okay.
He seemed like kind of a dirtbag before, but things are escalating.
Yes.
Because he fully had no reason. The nurse was not stopping him from leaving. Nothing was happening other than.
No, she was just checking in.
Back at the Fielding's house, Linda confides in Ellen that Max is scaring her. And he says, he hates me. He thinks, again, I'm a half-breed. He's in love with you. And who wouldn't be? You're a lady. You're rich. You're beautiful. I heard him trying his luck at camp. I heard him propositioning him. And Ellen says, look, forgive me for being blunt, Linda, but Max acted towards me the way he acts towards all women. You deserve better. He is not the man for you. When he is well, I understand he's recovering and you feel obligated to be there with him, and I respect that about you. But when he is well, then you know you can be free and happy. And Linda says, I can never be free, and my happiness lies with him. I'm in love with him, and I can't turn my back on him. And Ellen's like, ooh, girl, stand up. Allison, the phone rings.
Yeah.
It's the hospital, and they say something has happened with Max. The ladies don't even stay online to find out. They assume that maybe he's dead or taking a turn for the worse, so they rush in.
Right. Well, why would you guess that he's on a murderous rampage,
exactly,
beating nurses to death
they
and escaping
in
a hospital?
He runs to his room and sees a body covered in a sheet in his hospital room. She screams and she pulls it back. Unfortunately, it's the nurse, which is even worse. Like, at least if it's him, it's like, okay, we knew he was sick. It's like, oh, no, a dead woman. The doctor tells them that Max has fled on foot. They've called the cops, and the cops are doing a search of the streets for Max Gunther. And we sort of hear the detective tell all the officers to set up roadblocks, and we see a roadblock on top of a bridge, and we see Max hiding in a marsh underneath the bridge. But the cops and their search dogs are not far behind, and they end up chasing him. The dogs obviously have his scent, so they're sort of pursuing him, and it's not until Max is able to get to a creek, and he starts walking up the creek, and the dogs lose his scent, because I guess you can't scent in the water, or they're not able to. And we see him walk through the Mexican countryside. At one point, he falls face down in a patch of white flowers, which I love. Loved that image. He ends up near a village, and he's sort of hiding in a shack, and he sees a little girl eating a sandwich. And we see him grab what looks like sort of like a metal knife, or like a metal like tent peg almost, or like a wooden tent peg.
Sure.
From the shack, and he starts to creep towards this girl, and thank God the little girl's mother calls Dolores and has her come inside to help her with something. Otherwise, he was just gonna straight up murder that little girl for no reason.
Jesus Christ.
Fortunately, he's not able to murder this child. Back at the house, John talks with the professor, and he says, okay, I think that we understand that how Keltiki could have evolved. Let's say that, you know, Keltiki had the source of the volcanic energy. But then what is its bridegroom in the sky that gives Keltiki infinite power to destroy the world? And John laughs at the professor and says, well, I mean, maybe they were just being poetic, you know, or maybe you're giving the Mayan scientists a little too much credit. And the professor says, I don't know. I'm starting to think that they knew a lot more than us. It's like, well, yeah, about Keltiki, they probably did. They probably did.
Yeah.
They knew enough to build that temple down there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ellen comes down and they bid the professor adieu. And we see the professor in his car. And much like John, we hear him in his voiceover, like thinking through like the bridegroom in the sky, the bridegroom in the sky. Allison, when he leaves, we see that Max has sneaked through the gate onto the ground of the Fielding's home, which is stunning. And John gets a phone call to the house. It is the Betatron lab, and the assistant is screaming. The blob fragment, having been hit by the Betatron beam, has grown exponentially. It filled the room and has destroyed the Betatron laser.
Pronto? Sì, sono io, Fielding.
Chi è, John?
Cosa? Ne siete certi?
Ha invaso tutta la stanza e ha distrutto il Betatrone. E cresce ancora. Non sappiamo come fermarlo. Venga immediatamente.
Dategli fuoco. Date fuoco a tutto il laboratorio, se necessario, senza perdere un istante. Io vengo subito. Devo scappare.
And it's this great shot of like the assistant screaming, and then we see like the shadow of the blob and like smashing glass and people screaming, but you don't actually see the blob. Elegant.
I love that.
And John screams, set it on fire, because we know that's how it can be destroyed. He said, if you have to set fire to the laboratory, there's no time to waste. It can't escape into the city. So basically, if this gets out, it could just start killing people. It just blow up the building. Like, it's not worth it at this point. We don't understand it enough to control it. So whatever you could do to burn it, just do it. So John runs to his car to drive to try to help. And we see that Max is hiding in the Fielding's basement. He has crept inside, and as soon as John gets in his car and drives away to the lab, we see Max rip the telephone line in two.
Oof,
so Max is now in the Fielding's home. He is deranged, and he is, of course, obsessed with Ellen, and he has disconnected the telephone just as John is leaving the home. And, of course, nobody has a cell phone back then.
No. Of course.
We see again, the professor is like, the bridegroom in the sky. Maybe this is tied to something that happened in the sky that the Maya knew about. The professor and assistant go to the local observatory. Thank God it's all within driving distance.
Yes, yes.
And they ask
every town has one.
Exactly. And they ask the astronomer for help, the astronomer on call. And the professor says, do you know by any chance if there was a celestial phenomenon in 607 AD? And then Starbuck says, you're asking me if there was a celestial phenomenon in 607 AD? Well, there was, actually. And he says, the comet passed by the Earth that year. It was seen and recorded across the globe, including in Byzantium by Emperor Justinian's astronomers. And the ancients called it Arsinoe. And they classified it as a malign star because it caused all these disruptions across the globe. And we now know it was covered in a radioactive dust. So it probably was interfering with like all of these different things in the atmosphere. And Professor's like, oh my God, that's right. A comet like that would have caused an increase in radioactivity in the atmosphere everywhere. And the astronomer says, yes, but I'm not sure how much, but we'll have more information about that tomorrow. And the professor says, well, why tomorrow? And the astronomer replies, well, because the comet's returning tonight. It comes near the Earth.
Of course.
Once every 1,352 years. The professor says, oh my God, we have to destroy the fragments. The professor calls the Fieldings, but of course, Max has disconnected the line.
Yes.
And he says to his assistant, you go to the Betatron lab, destroy the fragment there. Because they don't know that the thing's gone crazy either, because nobody has any phones.
Right.
Do whatever you have to do to destroy the fragment. I am going to go to John Fielding's house and warn them, because he also has that little bit in his lab and it's going to start growing. Fortunately, at least for the Betatron lab, Fielding arrives at it. Allison, it's already exploded. It killed the watchman and also the blob. They think like the laser itself exploded, but then it did kill the blob at least. So that part of Kel-Tiki, the immortal monster, not so mortal after all. Okay. Mm-hmm. And we know it can be killed with fire. The professor, Allison, we see the professor and he's like, dear God, the comet's going to cause radiation. And we see the comet to appear in the sky. And it's like sort of that very classic 50s sci-fi. It's like, we don't know. Very classic, spooky comet sounds. Suddenly, a truck appears from him in this two-lane road. The professor jerks the wheel and his car, which is a little toy car, flies off a cliff, lands nose down, and explodes into flames. Now, I don't think the comet did that, but also, I don't know that much about comets.
Nope, me neither.
It's late enough that Ellen and Jenny are asleep. Ellen wakes up when she hears Jenny crying and goes to comfort her. And Jenny tells her, I saw a bad man in the house. I saw him. Ellen, of course, is like, it was just a nightmare. I promise you, you're totally safe. I'll lay down with you till you go to sleep and then I will go to sleep. You're fine. And once Jenny's asleep, we see Ellen walk to the top of the stairs and see a door open. She's like, oh, fuck. And she creeps down the stairs to find it's just Linda. She's made herself a late night full meal.
Okay.
And Linda's like, oh, I was just hungry, you know, the stress of everything. And I was like, yeah, this has been a hard week. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's only been a fucking week.
Jesus.
She's like, well, I'm going to head to bed. Good night. I'll see you in the morning. Of course, as soon as Ellen turns to go back upstairs, we see Ellen's face fall. We see Linda take the tray of food through John's office where she doesn't notice a smaller blob is pulsing. So it's been awakened by the comets. And she goes into the far door to the basement. And of course, Max is in the basement and she's bringing him food.
Yeah.
And Linda tries to stand up to him to her credit. She's like, I love you, but you cannot stay here. I will never betray you to them. But I'm not going to feed you if you leave here. You should go back to the hospital. I don't know what your problem is. John is your friend. He has been working tirelessly to try to help you. Maybe it seems like he's your enemy in some way now, but when you're back to normal, and he freaks out, he's like, are you saying I'm not normal? I'm perfectly normal. And then he says, remember, I will kill you if you tell anyone I'm down here. It's like,
Jesus.
Maybe that's that new normal I've been hearing about, that Kel-Tiki normal, but Kel-Tiki not a great normal. Sign. But of course, Linda's in love with him, so she's going to endanger her own life to help him. For the assistant then makes it to the Betatron lab, or what's left of it, as the fire department sort of picks through the refuse, and he tells Fielding the whole thing. There's the comet, it's going to cause radiation. The professor, the professor's coming, is going to your house to try to warn you. And he tells him that, and the Fielding says, oh, of course, he immediately makes a connection, like, oh my God, there's a fragment in my lab. Call the police and the army and tell them to bring flamethrowers, because whatever it is, it can only be killed by fire.
Yes.
So Fielding starts speeding home, And we see the comet in the sky again, and it does its spooky little tune. And we see Allison, the fragment in Fielding's home, has doubled and then tripled. And finally, it pushes its way out of its container and explodes, setting shattering glass everywhere. And it flops off the science table, and it starts growing. And soon it's the size of like a sofa, like a disgusting wet sofa. Ugh. And it's growing, and it knocks over a shelf covered in, you know, vials. And Ellen wakes up.
Of course, vials.
Thinking it's her husband in the lab, and it's like, John, she goes to turn the lights. Allison, the power is out. Max has cut the power to the house.
Not great.
We see her open the door to the dark hallway, and Ellen starts to make her way. And unfortunately, she is grabbed by a hand. It's Max, obviously. Yeah. And he is deranged. He sort of backs her into the master bedroom, and he says, I cut out the electricity. No one can come to your aid. You're in my power now, and you're the only woman that I want. Ellen's trying to reason with him, but eventually she just has to fucking like slap him and run past him into Linda's arms. And Linda says to Max, you promised me. Allison, he tells her to get out of the way, and we see that he has grabbed a gun.
Of course.
And Linda says, give me the gun. Don't do this. Don't hurt either of us. And she approaches him. Of course, Max shoots Linda dead and grabs Ellen. And Max screams in Ellen's face, obey me or I'll kill your little girl too. Allison, just then they hear a real blob-like sound from the lab.
Real blobby.
Kaltiki vibes. However, Max doesn't know that John has a fragment or doesn't know it's at his house. So he hears a sound in the lab and thinks it's John. So he says, come out, Dr. John Fielding, or I'm going to shoot you through this door. Allison, the wall explodes, and the blob, which is, I'm going to say, the size of a Toyota Sienna this time, flows over Max, subsuming him, and we see his screaming, fleshless skull stripped of skin as he's absorbed into the mass of Kaltiki. It's a feature wrap on Max.
Yeah. Well,
Ellen runs upstairs because the blob is basically filling the entire living room. Like it's metastasizing, right? Allison, now all of the blob shots are in a dollhouse replica of the Fielding's house.
I
loved it. Because again, like it looks like a bunch, like, I mean, like it looks like 500 pairs of wet jeans all tied together, covered in mucus, filling your living room, which is unsettling.
It's very unsettling.
Ellen runs to the second story window, throws it open, screams for help. Of course, nobody's nearby. Ellen runs to Jenny, but by the time she runs back to the stairs, the blob is coming up the stairs to the second floor. So they're kind of trapped there for now. And she is forced eventually onto the second floor window ledge, and she's holding her toddler daughter like on her chest and is like scooting in her nightgown around the ledge to try to get to another part of the house to get to another stairwell.
Yes.
Of course, unfortunately, by the time they get back inside, the blob is everywhere. It is filling the first floor, trapping them on the second floor. John is speeding home, and he blows past one of the police stops that they had set up for Max. Allison, because he does not stop, the police chase him down. They force him to stop, and they haul him to the station to arrest him for speeding and blowing past the stop. And he has to try to reason with the police chief, but everything he's saying is so insane. He's like, you must be drunk as hell, and put him in an interrogation room and you can calm down.
No.
So they throw John into an interrogation room. And of course, we're cutting back and forth between this of John like pounding at the door, screaming, trying to open a window, as Ellen looks down and sees the blob is now big enough that it's oozing out of the first floor windows.
No.
So it's not just filling the first floor. It's like emerging out onto the lawn, right?
Imagine being their neighbor. And like looking out the window and just seeing that and being like, what the hell?
We also see that it's sort of like it's starting to like cleave. And the way that it's put together, it's almost like lobes of a brain. And you sort of like see these cleavages start to appear in the material of Kaltiki the Immortal Monster. Unfortunately, Ellen is forced to take Jenny up into the attic. So now they have the third floor. And we see, again, the blob is coming down another hallway. And a little dollhouse chair tips over. And the little dollhouse mirror falls off. Loved it. John is freaking out at the police station. And eventually, he's able to take the chair. And there's a really high window, like that he can't climb out of, but he smashes the window. And then when one of the police officers run in, he assaults him, clobbers him, and is able to escape past him to leap out another window and get to his car. John is not giving up easily, and I appreciate this whole sequence.
It's impressive.
It's like, I'm not just about science. Of course, he peels off at his car. The police are in hot pursuit. They shouldn't have left his keys on him, I guess. We see Ellen is sort of looking out the attic window at like the drop, like, do we jump? But again, like, the blob is oozing out the side of the house. So it's like, even if you were to jump, I'd be afraid you'd just fall onto the blob itself.
Yeah.
But there's a larger problem, Allison, which is that the blob is starting to knock over structural parts of the home. So the actual house is starting to collapse in on itself onto the blob. So they're going to die if they stay in anyways. Fortunately, the assistant is able to alert the authorities, and we see this alert, and the army is dispatched to the professor's house. And they put they tell everyone in the town that they cannot leave their home. There's an emergency, and they call in the army, and they call anyone who has a flamethrower to show up at the Professor Fielding's house. But will it be in time, Allison? We see John Fielding himself arrive at the house and, of course, see his poor wife and daughter screaming out the attic window.
Jesus Christ.
It must be the size of, it's at least the size of an Olympic pool, and it's only getting bigger, oozing out the first story of his house. The cops arrive right behind him because they were chasing him down. And as soon as they get to the house, they're like, oh, he was telling the truth. And they just start shooting the blob.
Yeah.
But John's like, the bolts are not going to do anything. We need flamethrowers. No, like, you could shoot it. Exactly. Luckily, the police chief arrives and tells his officer, withdraw. The army calls. The army's right behind us. They have flamethrowers. And the cop says, the professor is right. The garden is full of monsters. Allison, the blob is starting to divide or to reproduce. So basically, it's like splitting off into different blobs.
Yes.
That are sort of filling all these different areas of the home and now the garden. Fortunately, the army arrives and it's time to kick some of that Kaltiki, the immortal monster, ass. And they light their flamethrowers and they are blasting the blob. And this was very fun.
Yes.
This whole sequence. And as the blob is burned, like a pair of jeans, it starts to bleach and shrivel up, like dry up.
Okay.
When it's hit with a flamethrower. However, Evelyn and Jenny are still trapped in the house, which is collapsing. And John's like, I cannot watch this. I cannot take this. He runs to the house and he's able to get his hands on a ladder that's tall enough to go to the attic. And he puts it against the window just as the attic door explodes in. So the other blob is in the attic. So they kind of don't have any other option. Like, they're going to have to go out the window anyways.
Yeah.
John's able to get up to them just as the blob emerges into the room. He grabs his wife. He grabs his daughter. But when they look down, the blob is swarming up the bottom of the ladder. So there's a blob below, a blob above, and John does the only thing that he could think to do. He pushes the ladder away from the house, and the ladder is tall enough that they fall to the ground, tumble to the ground, but at least they fall clear of the blob.
Yes.
And while they are injured, they're able to get up and sort of like crawl past the edge of the blob, and the army runs in and starts roasting this bitch. Good. Fortunately, they're able to kill the smaller blobs. And then suddenly we see over behind the house emerges a gigantic mansion-sized blob, probably the original fragment.
Yes.
And the army retreats because they're like, we don't even know if we can even potentially do this.
Yeah.
And John screams at them, I know you called in the tanks. Bring in the tanks. The entire city is in danger. You have to do whatever you can. Allison, the tanks appear, and thank God they have flamethrowers as well. And the tanks are all little tiny toy tanks that are zooming towards a little toy dollhouse, and I loved it.
I love that.
It is the least compelling cinematic appearance of tanks in any movie I've ever seen. Because you're like, oh, hell yeah, the tanks. And it's like, fortunately, the tanks have flamethrowers. They let loose, and they were able to destroy and shrivel down the gargantuan super blob that was the Kaltiki mother, I guess in like a kombucha mother sense. More like Kaltiki, the mortal monster. Check it. The danger thwarted. The army withdraws. And Ellen, John, and Jenny, who's asleep in the back seat of their car, survey the wreckage of their completely obliterated house. Like, there's nothing they can even go in and get. Everything they've ever owned is destroyed. You got blobbed. And you know your insurance is going to fight you on it.
Yes.
And Ellen says, please take us away from here. And John hugs her and says, the danger is over. You have nothing to be afraid of, darling. Kaltiki is destroyed forever, and our beautiful white family is okay. And I thought for sure they were going to show a little blob, like in the basement or something. But no, they just drive away into the night.
Okay.
Kaltiki defeated. The end.
Wow.
Also, what are some fatal mistakes you think were made in Kaltiki, the immortal monster?
mistakes.
I mean, bringing a little bit of Kaltiki into your home.
Big time. That's the biggest mistake.
Like, I think that's the, it's like, obviously it's like, yes, even just like going and excavating and like fucking around with those caves.
Mm-hmm.
It was already, but it's like, I get it. We are like, we do have, exploring as part of human nature, but like, you're going to put it in your house. Like, that's that's what got away from them. And I think that ultimately the biggest.
Absolutely. Because like, you couldn't have known all that stuff in the beginning. I mean, you there were definitely hints that you shouldn't have gone in those caves or into that pool. But I think the hubris, the overweening pride of bringing in, again, I wouldn't even bring a big dog, I don't know, into a house with a toddler.
No.
You know what I mean?
No.
I wouldn't bring a knife into it. Like, it just seems like the most dangerous thing on the planet, and you've chosen to bring it into your home, even though we see you have access to at least two other labs, because we see the lab with the carbidating, the lab with the Betatron that you did bring it to. So it's like, why not keep it safely in a lab where they can be monitored and contained?
Yeah.
That's on you, John.
That's on you, John.
And that is what his insurance company is probably going to argue. It's like, you brought this as an act of God. You brought in Kaltiki, the immortal monster. And then, Allison, where would you place Kaltiki, the immortal monster, on the spooky scale?
A spooky scale.
I think overall, like, as a film, not scary, but some really scary effects.
Yeah,
so I have three.
Oh,
like
three.
The
okay.
Gooiness and the just the whole, the blobs, whole deal. Some of that was really gross. So
yeah,
a three. What about you?
I'm gonna give it a three as well. There were a lot of moments I really liked. I agree. Like, it wasn't necessarily scary, just as much as like, a blob is unlikely to you know, destroy me or anyone I know. But the visuals were great. The acting was really fun, and the images of, like, for example, Max's fleshless screaming skull being subsumed in the blob, that got me. That really got me. And I guess I also really like these older movies. I love these that we're doing.
They're
really compelling.
Thanks, moms.
Yeah, thanks, mom. And also, my mom is correct. This is scary, and also would be terrifying if you were a child.
Yes. And
there's also a
like,
child in it. You know what I mean? So I feel it's like, oh no, I'm watching a child also be in it. That also
this could happen. Yeah. And also, like, back before, like, some of our effects in film got so, like, this, I believe, was probably the most, like, the scariest effects that were getting made at the time. Like, what's the scariest thing now that you could see too young? Like, I feel like it's the same one to one.
Yeah.
It's not like it exists in the landscape of, like, us watching this from now. You know?
Exactly. Like, yes, I completely agree. Like, you're seeing this, the movie effects are hitting you differently.
Yes.
I guess that our version of it is like when we go through periods of bad CGI, you know, like some of it's really well done. Some of it's like, oh, well, that's not scary. That looks incredibly fake.
Yes.
So,
yes.
All right, great. Guys, we hope you enjoyed this one. This movie was actually, I believe, 1 hour and 16 minutes. So this episode is actually longer than the movie itself.
We had a lot to get through.
And until next time, please keep it spooky.
Bye.
Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Ruin Podcast, or join us at patreon.com/ruin podcast for exclusive episodes and video content. Ruin is a Radio Point production with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Dan Powell, and Houston Snyder.
Recorded and edited by Sage Spielman.